And what sort of man was Freud?
Well, he was a complicated nature, you know. I liked him very much. But I soon discovered that when he had thought something, then it was settled. While I was doubting all along the line, it was impossible to discuss something really. So from the very beginning, there was a discrepancy.
Carl Jung in 1959. Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlette Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue.
Before we start this podcast, we have a rare correction. If you listen to our August 10th podcast on treatment-resistant anxiety, we mentioned that the dose of Pindolol for panic disorder is 2.5 milligrams a day. It's actually 2.5 milligrams three times a day. We corrected the error a couple hours after the podcast was released, so if you listened to it after the first day of release, you already got the correct information. Leo Rangel was a firebrand of a man. He had led the American Psychoanalytic Association in the 1960s, and in 2002 he came back to their annual meeting to defend psychoanalytic theory from the forces of cultural relativism that threatened to dilute it. His crosshairs were focused on intersubjectivity, a branch of psychoanalysis which held that the analyst does not have a unique grasp on objective truth, but that the insights that arise out of psychoanalysis are more of a helpful fiction that's created between the analyst and the patient. Fiction, relativism, pluralism, postmodernism, Dr. Rangel had no patience for these ideas. In his mind, psychoanalysis was even more pure than the scientific method, a knife that, when correctly applied, would reveal the true inner workings of the human mind.
Compared to all other pursuits, I think the analyst, in the objective part of his analytic attitude, which he retains even if he has a corrective goal, is more after the truth than most scientists.
In the ongoing debate over one theory or many, he began, I favor one, total, unified, and cumulative. He went on to call for a return to Freud's theories of the mind that he laid out in the early 1900s, to bring back the id, the ego, and the superego.
In the last 20 or 30 years, we have a period of multiple theories, multiple views, pluralistic ideas about what causes mental conflict. But to me, it all stands on a base of the discoveries from 1890 to 1910 and 20 and 30.
I asked Dr. Rangel how his approach would help patients. It's not the job of psychoanalysis to help people, he told me. It may and it may not help symptoms. But what we can do is deliver the truth, with a capital T. Well, I thought, at least he was honest. Dr. Rangel's Sermon on the Mount ultimately failed to move the field. Insight, the introspective quest for truth about the self, usually doesn't rank at the top of the list of agents of change in psychotherapy. Warmth, empathy, behavioral change, and the therapeutic alliance usually rest there at the top. But in this month's Carlette Report, we present new data on insight as a force of change in psychotherapy. Insight is traditionally associated with psychoanalysis and psychodynamic therapy, often called the insight-oriented therapies, but it plays a part in nearly every psychotherapy. And, with apologies to Dr. Rangel for diluting the concept, today we're going to look at how those different therapies view insight. Through that journey, we'll see that these therapies are more alike than not in how they use it. First stop, psychoanalysis. Here, the idea of insight is deep and broad. It means awareness of unconscious drives and conflicts, of resistance and transference. As Freud put it, understanding and cure almost coincide in psychoanalysis. But from its early days, psychoanalysts struggled with the everyday reality they faced in practice. Insight by itself did not lead to cures. At least two other ingredients were necessary. The patient had to arrive at the insight on their own. And second, the insight they arrived at had to be more than an intellectual understanding. It needed an emotional component to instigate change. They had to feel it.
Cognitive therapy is born. Fast forward to 1954, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. A young psychoanalyst named Aaron Beck has run into a problem. Dr. Beck had recently joined the faculty at the University of Pennsylvania and was testing out Freud's theories on depression. Those theories were not holding up to empirical tests, and this was not going to bode well for Beck's role at the University of Penn, which, like many other mid-century psychiatric departments, was yoked to psychoanalytic theory. Freud believed that depression was caused by repressed anger. Well, repressed stuff is supposed to come out in dreams. So Beck studied the dreams of depressed patients, hoping to find themes of repressed anger. He didn't. The dreams of depressed people were much like their conscious lives, overburdened with loss and rejection, with little trace of anger and hostility. Meanwhile, Beck's day job as a fledgling psychoanalyst raised further doubts. While treating a woman with anxiety, he suggests that her anxiety was caused by unconscious attempts to repress her own sexual impulses. The patient didn't seem convinced, and Beck paused to ask what was going through her mind when he made that interpretation. "Actually," she said, "I was more worried that I was boring you. It's a thought I often have when I'm with other people." Experiences like this led Beck to shift away from psychoanalytic insights about unconscious conflicts and move toward cognitive insights about automatic thoughts like, "I'm boring." By changing those automatic thoughts, patients could change how they feel and live, and thus cognitive therapy was born. But it soon ran into the same hurdle that psychoanalysis did. Whether it was an analytic interpretation or a challenge to automatic thoughts, patients didn't change much unless their new beliefs came with some emotional weight. As Albert Ellis, a co-founder of the cognitive approach, put it, "It appears that simply comprehending the notion that one's beliefs are dysfunctional or irrational is insufficient in fostering change." Thus, the primary appeal to logic and reason during the process of disrupting irrational beliefs, while compelling, may be rather limiting in the long run. Ellis drew the same line between emotional and intellectual insight as a psychoanalyst had. "Emotional insight," he wrote in 1963, "is a radically different, essentially more forceful, effective, and committed kind of behavior."
Insight in behavior therapy. In the 1970s, cognitive therapy and behavior therapy merged, effectively putting the B in CBT. But the two are not always happy cabin mates, and in some ways, cognitive therapy's approach to insight bears more resemblance to psychoanalysis than to behavior therapy. Unlike analysts and cognitive therapists, the behavior therapist has no interest in whether a patient's beliefs and insights are true or false. They view beliefs as behaviors. Thinking is a behavior, as is feeling. That's right, feeling is a behavior. It sounds strange to our ears because we're used to thinking of behavior as an act of free will, while feelings are reactions. But free will has no concept in behavior therapy. The behaviorist is interested in what happens and the reinforcers that make it more or less likely to happen again, whether that happening is a behavior, a feeling, or a thought. Here's how that looks in therapy. Both cognitive and behavioral therapists start with a situation, like, "My friend called and asked me to go out to dinner." The cognitive therapist then wants to know about the automatic thought that was triggered by the situation, such as, "I'm not likable." The thought then causes a behavior, "So I stayed at home." The behavior therapist skips right over the thought and goes into the action. The invitation triggered a behavior, "I stayed at home." The behavior then has a consequence, "I felt less anxious." Aha, says the behavior therapist. When you stay at home, you feel better. You feel less anxious. So we've discovered what reinforces your avoidance. You're doing it for a good reason. So how does the behavior therapist help people change? They help the patient get in touch with the positive reward of going out to dinner or the long-term negative result of staying at home. To do this, they connect the actions with the emotions through questions like, how does it affect your life to stay at home and turn down invitations? They might try to connect staying at home with more heartfelt, emotive values that the patient holds. Say, if the patient values building friendships, the therapist might ask, how is staying at home consistent with your values, dreams, and plans? Just like therapists before them, they are trying to make these ideas emotionally relevant.
The dangers of insight. Where ignorance is bliss, 'tis folly to be wise, wrote the poet Thomas Gray in 1742. Some have questioned whether too much insight is a good thing. It's uncomfortable to learn of one's own fears, doubts, conflicts, painful memories, or paranoid beliefs. One place where insight can go wrong is rumination. Rumination is a repetitive style of thought that keeps wrestling with a problem without ever arriving at a conclusion. We see it a lot in depression, and the things that trigger rumination are the same themes that contribute to insight. Thoughts about the self, about the meaning of things, and existential questions like, why does this keep happening to me?
Rumination-focused CBT is a new form of cognitive therapy developed by Edward Watkins. We interviewed him in June of 2018. There's some evidence that addressing rumination through RF-CBT can bring patients to fuller remission from depression than regular CBT. RF-CBT looks on rumination as a behavior, and it's a slightly addictive one, even when it's painful. It is reinforced. One reinforcer of rumination is insight. Patients who ruminate often report that rumination gives them greater insight into the self so they can solve problems and learn from past mistakes. Research, though, shows the opposite. These same patients have poorer problem-solving abilities than non-ruminators. My own sense is that rumination is problem-solving gone awry. It's like when you're trying to close a broken window in an antique house, and you can't get it quite closed, but you keep pushing from different angles. All the while, you think you're getting closer, but you really just keep breaking the window more. Rumination thinks that it's solving a problem, thinks that it's getting closer, it's almost there, but it never gets anywhere. When patients ruminate, it gives them the illusion that they're solving a problem, and that feels good, it's reinforcing. But in reality, they never take action or arrive at a decision. They remain with the same level of depressive avoidance as before they ruminated. Therapy is supposed to be a place where you mull over problems, but that's also a setup that can fuel more rumination in these patients. So RF-CBT comes with a warning to avoid co-ruminating with the patient, lest the therapy turn into a two-party exercise in rumination. Here's how you'll know if a patient is ruminating with you. They bring you a problem like, my cousin moved in with me and I can't stand him. You offer a reasonable solution like, have you tried sitting down with your cousin to clarify your expectations? And the patient replies, yes, but, and goes on to tear down that good idea. After a few volleys like this, you're likely to feel as defeated and depressed as the patient. And that's exactly what happens when you're not there with the patient. The patient, in their own mind, thinks of problems all day, conjures up solutions, and then defeats those solutions with the old, yeah, but the ruminative stream just keeps going in circles. One reason that patients ruminate is to avoid negative feelings. In ruminating, they are being overly abstract and rational, instead of sitting with the nitty-gritty details of their life, because those details are too painful. better to think about life than to actually live it. So in RFCBT, they use techniques like mindfulness, compassion, and concrete thinking, which is where you get the patient to slow down and get into all the sensory details of their story instead of the abstract meanings, to help shift people out of the ruminative realm and into a more grounded, heartfelt space. And here is where our podcast comes full circle. From psychoanalysis to CBT, all therapists seem to agree that insight is helpful when it's grounded in emotions. And it's that lack of grounding that creates rumination and fuels depression. Like we talked about on 60 Second Psych episode on August 15th, called Depressed and Indecisive, people with depression are indecisive because they have trouble attaching emotional weight to any decision.
In the late 1980s, psychologists Quaken and Matthews conducted an EEG experiment that pulls this all together. They asked people to think about a problem in their life. One group was asked to pay attention to their feelings, while the others were asked to do so in a more intellectual way, searching for an explanation to make sense of the problem. While they mulled over the problem, EEGs attached to the head revealed an interesting pattern. The emotional thinkers had more activation in the right hemisphere, which is associated with feelings and creativity, while the rational thinkers were more active in their logical left hemisphere. And the emotional thinking seemed to work better, at least by EEG. Theta bursts, which are EEG patterns that tend to happen when people arrive at new insights, were 3 times as common in the emotional thinkers as the rational ones. Emotions guide us and ground us. Without them, insights fall flat, leave no theta burst, and don't lead to any change. And now for the word of the day, insight. Wait, we just covered insight.
No, this is the secondary meaning. When we use insight in psychopathology, we're talking about whether a patient is aware that they have an illness. The original idea of insanity was that people lost all awareness. But in the early 1800s, psychiatrists started to recognize that some patients were actually aware that their thinking was off. In 1820, Georgette wrote that a small number of patients were able to assess their own mental state, who say, "I have an ill head, a disturbed spirit, I can no longer think, I know that my own thoughts are disordered, I am behaving badly, but I cannot do otherwise." The first empiric study of insight was conducted in 1870 at the French asylum Vaucluse. It found that only 10% of psychiatric admissions had awareness of their condition. Patients who lack insight are thought to have more severe forms of the disorder, but you have to be careful about raising insight. In 2001, psychiatrists in Edinburgh randomized 114 patients with schizophrenia into 2 groups. The first group watched a 15-minute educational video about their illness, schizophrenia, and received some pamphlets about schizophrenia prior to their discharge, and the other group got no such education. When they followed up a few months later, the ones who got the impersonal education had more suicidal thoughts. That's not to say that education has no role in schizophrenia, but it has to be done with a human touch. When integrated into a therapeutic program that teaches skills to live with schizophrenia, psychoeducation reduces suicidality.
Join us next week for an interview with Nasir Gami on existential despair in bipolar depression. Send your feedback and questions of all things psychiatry to asktheeditor@thecarlettreport.com. You can read the full articles and earn CME credits at thecarlettreport.com, where we have a special offer for our podcast listeners. You can get $30 off your first year subscription with the promo code PODCAST in all caps.
The Carlatt Report is one of few CME publications that depends entirely on subscribers. Thank you for helping us stay free of commercial support.